Ladies and gentlemen, welcoming back to the Ray Carr Show. And it's, boy, are we ever grateful to have this. He's quite an expert. He wrote the book, How to Host a Game Night, Eric Arneson. And Eric, I know that you're a Green Bay Packers fan. My condolences to you. They did not make the Super Bowl this year, but they certainly had a good year.
They did. They had a great year. It was another fun run. It's always a little painful to lose in the NFC Championship, you know, just one step away from the Super Bowl. And we've done it twice in a row now, but we've got Aaron Rodgers, so there's always hope.
There certainly is. And you've been very lucky. You know, Don Majkowski was the quarterback before Brett Favre, so you've had a long stretch of really good quarterbacks.
Yeah, that's right. The Magic Man. I actually saw Don Majkowski play in person once down in Dallas. My parents lived down there, and Dad and I went to a game in the old Texas Stadium and saw Don Majkowski beat the Cowboys.
Wow, that was quite a while ago. But hey, you know, football in Green Bay, it's an institution, and, you know, we'll see. Probably the Packers, they will certainly be back next year. But
I hope so.
Yeah. We're going to talk about, by the way, we mentioned a book earlier, How to Host a Game Night. I would highly, highly recommend the book, Games for Everybody, All Ages. And tonight, we're going to speak to Eric about another couple of good games. And Eric, what do you have on tap for the audience?
Well, I was hoping to talk tonight, Ray, about Password, based on the classic game show, and a more modern game called Codenames, which has some similarities to Password, but takes it in a new direction. And I think they're both fun games.
Yeah, Password. I remember watching that on TV with Alan Ludden. That was Betty White's husband at the time.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it started back in, I want to say, 1961.
Yeah.
First aired, and just a great, great game show.
It certainly was. Now, let's talk about the modern. Is this a modern version of Password, or basically the same kind of game that Password was?
So it's the same kind of game called, it's called Codenames, and what you do in this game is you lay out a grid on the table, 5x5 of cards. And each card has a single word on it. And there's two teams playing against each other, just like on Password. And each team leader, the person giving the clue, is given a sort of a map. And so if you and I are on a team and I'm giving clues, I want to give you clues that make you identify, I believe it's 7 of the 25 cards that are laid out. Meanwhile, I don't want you to guess the ones that are good for the other team. There are some neutral cards, and then there's one that is an assassin. So if I give you a clue that makes you choose that card, we lose instantly. So it's similar to Password, but the number of choices are limited, and there's always that tension, because it's amazing how often a clue that you give can lead somebody to a word you didn't expect them to choose.
So the element of surprise is a major part of this game.
Yes, absolutely. Well said. The element of surprise. And, you know, I love word games, and I've always enjoyed Password. And this is just a refreshing new twist on that same kind of classic. Give a one-word clue. Try to get your partner to guess the right answers.
Now, when did this game actually come out?
Codenames came out in 2015 and has become pretty wildly popular, actually. It's available at Target and mass market stores like that, and there are several editions now. There's a Disney version, a Harry Potter version, a lot of versions of Codenames out there now.
Yeah, that sounds really like a lot of fun. And, you know, with the COVID situation in all different parts of the country, you just never know. And if you want to if you stay home a lot, these are great options for you, and I would highly recommend.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, you know, in the book, I mean, you have so many ideas, no matter what your choice is. I mean, if you're into sports, if you're not into sports, if you're into, you know, strategy, there's a lot of games for that. Ticket to Ride, a friend of mine bought Ticket to Ride and played it with the family, and they thought it was a fantastic game. So
it's Ticket to Ride is great. Yeah, it's you know, Ticket to Ride sort of for me hits that sweet spot in strategy games where there's plenty of strategy there, plenty of things to think about and tactics you can take to try and win the game. But at the end of playing Ticket to Ride, your brain doesn't hurt. You know, I respect chess, but I don't like chess because it makes my brain hurt. Ticket to Ride, I love that game.
What are some of the other games that somebody over the age of 45, 50 would thoroughly enjoy? Are there any games that are kind of geared for that age group?
You know, it's interesting. I go to a lot of gaming events all across the country, obviously fewer since the pandemic started. But the beautiful thing about board games is that so many of them can be enjoyed by a wide range of ages. And so I think when you're talking about games that you know, might appeal to a certain age, and that category you just listed happens to include me, I think what I look for more than a genre of game, so to speak, you know, a strategy game or a party game, I look for what the game's about. And lately there have been a lot of games coming out, a lot of really good games coming out based on movies that were popular in the 70s and the 80s. And I'll mention three briefly. There's a board game based on Jaws, which is just terrific fun. Again, it's a strategy game. You're trying, obviously, not to get eaten by the shark, but that's a terrific one. There are a couple of board games based on Back to the Future, which obviously was a big movie franchise in the 80s, and those are excellent. And my favorite of this group is called the Princess Bride Storybook Game, I believe is its full title, but based on the Princess Bride, which for my money is a top five movie without any question at all. So I think nostalgia is a big part of the appeal of games like that, but all three of those are excellent games on their own.
Now, where do you hear about the games? I mean, is there like a general place where new release games are found? People would like to find out, hey, what's the new game this year?
Yeah, there's a website called BoardGameGeek.com, and that's a good place to go. Now, the users of BoardGameGeek, they do tend to be pretty heavy on the strategy end of things, but that's a great place to go. But really, where I go first is to YouTube. There's a wonderful YouTube channel called The Dice Tower. And Tom Vazel is the sort of the leader of The Dice Tower, but there are a lot of people who put out videos under The Dice Tower channel on YouTube all about games. I'd say 80% of their focus is new games. So if you want to know what's coming out or what has just come out, that's where I'd go first, The Dice Tower on YouTube.
Now, being a newspaper reporter, I mean, you're obviously a great writer. So tell me a little bit about what got you into writing about games. Was it that you were just an enthusiast and go, yeah, I want to write about games? Because not everybody gets to write about what they like.
You're very, very right, and I'm very lucky. Back in 1999, I was a writer for a website called About.com. My wife and I were both writing jointly about bed and breakfasts for this website, About.com. And it had, oh boy, at the time, I think there were probably 300 or 400 writers, each devoted to a specific topic. And there was somebody covering board games, and I followed what he was doing. And then he left About.com, and I applied to get that job. It was a freelance job, not full-time or anything, but a freelance job. And I did some freelance writing back then. And they accepted me, and so Beth kept writing about bed and breakfasts. I started writing about board games, and it just sort of took off from there. I really dove into it and learned a lot by doing that. You know, when I started, I had no idea how many games there were out there that I would wind up loving. And I'll be forever grateful to About.com for giving me that gig.
I think we're all very grateful that you had that gig, because now we're, you know, benefiting from the fruits of all your labor. You know, I always thought about this one, Eric. Are different board games more popular in different parts of the country? And if that is true, why?
You know, it is true. I think that it is probably a little less true today than it used to be. And the classic example of that, or at least the one that I always go to, is a traditional trick-taking game called Euchre. It's just played with a normal deck of cards. You take some of the cards out to play Euchre, but very popular in the Midwest. And so, you know, you go back 100 years, and that sort of regional popularity of card games in particular was much more pronounced. But these days, a lot of that sort of regional popularity is really driven by retailers. If there's a good game store or a good game cafe in a region where the owner is, you know, respected by his customers or her customers and recommends games, it can have a really big influence on what is popular in that region or that town.
Now, going back a few years, what kind of games were popular in the turn of the century from, say, 1890 to 1910? I mean, were there, were board games evolving a lot at that point, or what was going on there?
Board games were evolving a lot at that point. Mass market board games were a thing. It started in the 1800s. Milton Bradley, of course, was one of the famous pioneers, and then George Parker, and I can't remember George's brother, but they became the Parker brothers. Some of the early pioneers, and there were some other companies back then. Lachlan was one of the big early publishers of American board games as well. And so there was a lot of development back then. There was a shift. When board games first were published, most of them had, or many of them had, a very moralistic, often religious kind of purpose to them. They were meant to teach lessons. They were meant to help children become good members of society. And one of the first games done by Milton Bradley was The Mansion of Happiness. And it was very much designed to teach lessons about good behavior versus bad behavior. And as you come into the 1990s, now look, I think games have lots of lessons to teach, essentially, no matter what they're about, in terms of sportsmanship and all sorts of other things. But as you move into the 1900s, games start having more of an entertainment factor, I'll say, and they start reflecting more of popular culture at the time. And so you start seeing games that are centered around the kind of entertainment that people were enjoying otherwise, be it circuses, or be it hunting or fishing, or any other kind of recreational activity that was popular at the time. So the theme of the games really expanded as you cross from the 19th century into the 20th.
Are there any games from that period that are like the holy grail of collectors, that they really would give anything to have a copy of that game? Are there any of those games left?
There are. You know, back then, there weren't the same kind of capabilities to mass produce a game as there are today, or even as there was in the 1940s and 50s, and especially the 60s. So yes, if you can find a game, or if you're a collector, one of the things that you often would look for are games from that era that are in very good to excellent condition. Now, those are hard to find, because back then people didn't, you know, buy a game and sort of sit it on a shelf and protect it. They bought the game to be played, and usually to be played by children. And as we all know, children don't always take the best care of games. So it's hard to find. But yes, anything from the Lachlan brothers or Milton Bradley, pre-1900 or early 1900s, definitely some value there and of great interest to collectors.
I was always wondering, Milton Bradley, the name pops up all, has, you know, synonymous with games. What is his background? Yeah. I mean, like, what do you know about Milton Bradley?
You know, I actually don't know that much about Milton Bradley's history outside of him being one of the first American publishers of board games. He was born in the United States. I know that. And he lived until the early 1900s. But he didn't really, that I'm aware of, didn't really make a name for himself in any field other than board games.
Yeah. The only thing I remember about him, I read a long time ago, was that he was born in Maine, I think, and he died in Springfield. And he was born a long time ago, somewhere in the early 1800s, around 1835 or 36, I believe. But that's, you know, back in the time when, like we mentioned, board games really weren't popular at all. People were playing maybe checkers or chess at the time.
Right. And I think everything you just said about his background, I think is spot on. That all rang a bell with me when you said it. And one of the first games he published, I think it might have been the first, was The Checkered Game of Life. That was pre-Civil War.
Wow.
So it was about 1860. And it was a revolution in board games. You know, prior to that, certainly you had the classic, you had checkers and backgammon and chess. All the games, Mancala, all the games that we sort of think of as ancient now. But the Checkered Game of Life was, if not the first, one of the very first to be an original design that was put out and purchased in large quantities by the public.
You know, here's another question I thought of, and I was looking at your book, and I look at it quite frequently, and I thought, you know, what would Eric do if he had to reconstruct Monopoly? What would you do to that game, and how would you change it? Or you might not change anything. But I have often thought, you know, somebody who really knows games, I know what I might do, but what would you do?
I'd do a couple of things. I think that Monopoly sometimes gets a little bit of a bad rap because people do two things. One, they miss a key rule. And two, they use a house rule that only makes the game longer. The house rule that makes the game go longer is putting money on free parking. When you land on free parking, it's just supposed to be a space where nothing happens, according to the rules. And a lot of people put money, you know, when they pay taxes, when they pay certain fines and that kind of thing, they put all that money in the middle of the table or the middle of the board, and somebody takes it when they land on free parking. There's no strategy to landing on free parking. It's just luck. And typically what you're doing, you're either making the most powerful, or you're giving somebody free money, not because of good gameplay, but just because they happen to land there. The other thing, the rule that people miss, is that if somebody lands on a property and they don't buy it, it immediately goes up for auction. So that greatly increases the speed of play because the total number of properties get put into play much more quickly with that rule, and that's very helpful. You know, in addition to that, if you were looking for original ideas of things I would do, I think I would completely reconstruct community chess and chance and look at giving those some powers that players can use throughout the game. You know, maybe something like where you can adjust a die by a pip, you know, make your roll one higher or lower, things like that to give players more control, not total control, because Monopoly needs to have some luck in it, but give players more control over wow. their choices.
Eric, I like that, actually. That's a very smart idea. And it would be nice of them to kind of maybe tinker with it and have, like, the 2020, you know? I think that would be kind of cool. So, you know, who knows? Maybe things will turn out that way. Now, one final question. Where can people get your book, and what is your website?
My website is just Eric Arneson, and it's E-R-I-K, Arneson.com. I'm on Twitter at Eric Board Games, so easy to find there. And the book, How to Host a Game Night, it's available anywhere books are sold. You can order it through local bookstores if they don't have it in stock, and you can certainly buy it at any of the online retailers as well.
Eric, you're the best, and I really enjoy our conversations.
Same here, Ray. I hope we get to do it again soon.
We will.